There are very, very few genres of non-fiction that I enjoy more than books written by science writers who really know their topic and are able to write about it in such a way that lay people like myself, who are interested but not particularly knowledgeable, have access to those books. And Dr. Henry G is one of those people. Henry is a paleontologist. He's an evolutionary biologist. He is an editor at the journal Nature. And I have just read the fourth book of his. Previous ones, I'd read The Accidental Species in Search of Deep Time, and Deep Time is a wonderful notion, the timescale of geologic events, which are that timescale is so unimaginably greater than the timescale of our lives and our plans. And I also read Jacob's Ladder, and I had as much joy in reading very recently A Very Short History of Life on Earth, 4.6 billion years in 12 chapters. The author is on the line to us from Norfolk. Henry, a very, very good afternoon.
Good afternoon, John. Thanks for having me.
It's such a pleasure. I mean, when you're trying to do this, when you're trying to encapsulate 4.2 billion years in a couple of hundred pages and 12 chapters, do you start by thinking, I must include this? Or do you start by thinking, what can I leave out? Or perhaps it's a combination of the two.
It's a combination. Basically, John, I just tell the story. It's such a fantastic story. It really is the greatest story there is, the story of life on Earth, with all sorts of adventures and cliffhangers and dreadful happenings and amazing recoveries. So I just decided to tell the story. And it was actually surprisingly easy. It was the easiest book I've ever written. It kind of told itself. So I didn't have to think too hard about leaving things out or putting things in. It just kind of, I just wrote it as it went along, and it just worked out really, really easily, I'm pleased to say.
But for example, when it comes to that time in Earth's deep time scale where the dinosaurs were around, you spend less time talking about the dinosaurs than you do about some of the other fauna, which might often get overlooked. And I wish I knew how to pronounce some of these things, because you write on page 99 that the dinosaurs were a relatively small sideshow in the Triassic carnival of dicynodonts, rhynchosaurs, something else, eatosaurs, phytosaurs, and giant amphibians.
Well, you know, I had this problem too, because it never occurred to me to know how to pronounce these things until I actually had to read, I actually recorded the audio book. And then I had problems. I thought, I was so used to writing a lot of these long, complicated names, it had never occurred to me to know how to say them. But about the dinosaurs, I figured that everybody knows everything there is to know about the dinosaurs. So rather than do a kind of long list of dinosaurs, there was this, there was that, there was the other, I made the chapter about dinosaurs very thematic. I decided to talk about how they became birds. So I started the chapter, Dinosaurs Were Always Built for Flight. And I show that how all the things you need for flight, feathers and light bones and a solid airframe and very good air handling and warm-bloodedness were in dinosaurs from the beginning. So that led me to write things like some of these really big four-footed dinosaurs were really not what we used to imagine as great big lumbering lizards, but as gigantic four-footed birds. So that allowed, I wanted to basically encapsulate that single thing in the chapter about dinosaurs, but I really had to have a chapter about dinosaurs.
Of course you did.
Oh, and the chapter about dinosaurs also includes some other good stuff, like the evolution of flowers, which happened in the time of the dinosaurs, but also, as you say, in the Triassic period, which was the period before the dinosaurs really got going, the Triassic period is kind of unjustly neglected, because the dinosaurs evolved then, so everyone forgets about all the other fantastic unpronounceable animals that lived in the Triassic. If I could go back to one period in the Earth's history, that's where I'd go. I'd go to the Triassic and watch some of these amazing, unlikely creatures that only lived in the Triassic and died out at the end of it.
I mean, there are some of the things I've sort of vaguely heard of before. I wouldn't have been able to describe what they are, but the names were sort of vaguely familiar to me. But, you know, when you introduce me to the Vetulicolians and the Unanozoans, what are these things? What are these things?
These things were small, squishy sea creatures that lived about 500 million years ago. And they looked like, a bit like tadpoles, and they were distant cousins of us, backboned animals, and also sea squirts and other things in the chordates, which is the wider group of animals that includes the backboned animals. But I love talking about these because they haven't been known for that long, and still people are trying to interpret the fossils and see what they are. I had the good fortune to go to China in 2010 and look at some of these animals myself under a microscope. I mean, some of them are quite big. They're a few inches long, but to look at the detail, you have to look under a microscope. And I have to say, the more I looked at them, the more puzzled I became. And that's part of the fun, because if you look at the history of life, there are all kinds of weird things that are very, very hard to interpret, because we have no ready means of comparison with animals in the modern day.
Yeah, I mean, I love the way you describe Cathay Myris, if I've got that even vaguely correct.
Fine. You're doing very well.
Thank you. Looked like an anchovy fillet, sans head, sans scale, sans ear, sans nose, sans brain, sans nearly everything. Poor old Cathay Myris, that's what you could say.
Yes, there's only one specimen known of Cathay Myris, only one. That's the great thing about fossilization. It's so rare and so chancy that it could easily have been completely missed. But it was discovered, and it is very much as described.
And you're constantly making the point, and I think perhaps it's a point that needs to be made, because perhaps people think that evolution had a kind of straight line. But you make the point that evolution is not goal-directed. It's not linear, that it doubles back on itself. You talk about one group of ungulates which, and I quote, with enthusiasm and in evolutionary terms great haste, returned to the water and evolved in whales. And some species of birds became land animals and then came back into birds again. So evolution is not a straight line of progress from A to Z. It's much more, I don't know, it's not circular, but it's much more something that's not linear.
Yeah. People tend to think of evolution, it's very easy to personify these things and think that there's some direction or goal or an end in view, but evolution has no memory or foresight. What happens is it acts on animals and plants very much in the moment, and it's a collection of various disparate things, such as the heredity of the animals and how many offspring it has, and the environment and its constant changeability and its interaction with other things. And Darwin wrote near the end of The Origin of Species, he wrote a metaphor of the tangled bank. He said, it's best to think of the natural world as a tangled bank with grass and flowers and worms writhing beneath and insects in the plants and birds flying above the insects. And they're all interacting moment by moment by moment. And it's the sum of the history of these interactions, if you can understand me, that gives rise to the pattern we see of evolution. So it's the process that gives rise to the pattern. And the pattern is not at all predictable. So things could have happened that didn't happen. I mean, for example, if the asteroid that hit the Earth 65 million years ago hadn't hit the Earth, there might be dinosaurs still around today and no humans. And the dinosaurs might have been evolved into all kinds of strange and interesting forms we can't imagine. So there are all these kind of little events that happen. Another one, the end of the Permian period 250 million years ago, when a series of volcanic eruptions in what is now China and then Siberia made the Earth so uninhabitable, it killed almost all life. And what happened in the Triassic period was life had to pick itself up and dust itself off and start all over again from the lucky remnants that happens to be left over. If that event hadn't happened, who knows what life might be like today?
In the last chapter, you kind of say, right, here we are, humans, we're on this planet, this is what we're doing, this is what the future holds. And you mentioned extinction there, and you argue that technically it's too early to talk about the sixth mass extinction, but you do think that the extinction of human life as we know it is, in evolutionary terms, in terms of the 4.2 billion years history of the Earth, is just around the corner.
Oh yes. Humans are mammals, and mammals tend to last around a million years, mammal species. And we've been around in one form or another for about a third of that time. Now, that doesn't mean that in another 600,000 years we're all going to suddenly drop dead, because it's an average. But humans are an exceptional species. We could all die tomorrow, or we could last for millions of years. However, I tended to think that I was vague about it in the book, but I've thought about it a bit more since, that there are a number of factors which suggest to me that the human species is going to become extinct sooner rather than later, like in the next few hundred to few thousand years.
And yet you applaud us for phasing out fossil fuels at the rate that we're currently doing it, and that rate does seem to be accelerating, although there are and will continue to be some holdouts.
Oh, well, yes. I think that as we're the only species which, as far as we know, has some awareness of our effect on the environment, it behooves us to behave ourselves and leave the planet in as nice a state as we found it when we first evolved. And although the human species is going to decline, I think it would be a good thing if we managed our decline sensibly and in a civilized way, and to make it as comfortable for ourselves as possible. I mean, we shouldn't think that extinction is going to happen tomorrow. And in the meantime, we all have to get up in the morning and put one foot in front of the other without falling over. And we rely on a supply of clean water and clean air and food to eat and crops to grow. And these things are only made possible thanks to a kind of unwritten contract we have with the rest of the environment, with all the insects that pollinate the plants, with the availability of fresh water, and managing all kind of aspects of the environment. And I think these things are important. I'm not one of these people who go around shouting about saving the environment or saving the planet, because the planet will go on quite happily without us. But people have been doing a number of things, as I say, in an unheralded way for 50 years or so, to start moderating human behavior towards the planet by being a bit more economical in the way we do things, large and small, with no one shouting about it. It's kind of market forces, or it could be that human beings unconsciously are coming to the realization that the planet can't support many more of us and we have to do more with less.
Thank you very, very much. Fascinating conversation and even more fascinating book. Dr. Henry Gee, that's spelled G-E-E, senior editor of the journal Nature. The book is called A Very Short History of Life on Earth, 4.6 billion years in 12 chapters.